Station number 13123, Mr. Cyril Mount.
Drill 7. What was your next move in Iraq, then?
The next, from this strange place, which I can't remember, which started with a Q, a three-letter name, which is quite pleasant, because we were down out of the mountains, and we were on a flatter plain, and the sort of a spring was beginning. This was maybe late January to February. And we did more training, as I say, more calibrating of guns and learning about these new wireless sets. And it looked, everybody was immensely relieved because it looked as though we were going to go into action, because anything would have been better than just sitting there. You know, although it was scary in a way to think we were going to go into action against what seemed to be an invincible German army, you know, it was better than just sitting on your ass digging and eating awful food like that. And so, yes, it was a long period of training which... Oh, and I got bronchitis, and I went into a field hospital near Baghdad. That's right. For about a fortnight. I must have caught a chill, a really bad chill. Because I couldn't get rid of this cold, and it went to my chest. And then I had these, like, pleurisy and pains in my chest and coughing up stuff. So I went to this hospital, tented hospital, near Baghdad. And then the regiment moved down to Baghdad. By which time it was about beginning of May. And it was getting hot, and it was quite pleasant. I mean, parts of Iraq are quite pleasant. But on the whole, my memories of Iraq are not very happy ones. And then, in a series of leaps, about 100 miles a day, I suppose, we crossed over through Transjordan and Syria. I think we must have gone through Syria as well. Syria first or second? I don't know. It was a long haul, anyway. We'd sort of just drop anchor for the night and then up again the next day. And there was no break. It was almost like a forced march. And we pulled into the base depot in Al-Maza, which is artillery base depot. And
in Egypt?
Yes. And again, I think new dial sights were issued and new theodolites, rangefinders, things like that. I think we were brought up to date, literally. I think probably the vehicles needed new tyres as well by then. You know, we were fitted out, and at that time we were also in touch with people who had come back to base, either wounded or for some other reason, that would come out of hospital, and they were talking about the invincibility of Germans, about this, you know, legendary figure, Rommel, who was kicking the shit out of us and driving us right back, you know, and Rommel would be in Egypt any day now, sort of thing. And, oh my God, you know, we're going into this. And then June? No, it took longer than we were there longer than I thought. I thought we were going to, you know, the flap seemed to be so intense that I thought they'd have pushed us right up there immediately. So it wasn't until sometime in June, I'm not sure of dates at all anymore, I hadn't kept a diary. I wish I had. I was doing drawings rather than diaries, but even then it was such a panic that I didn't even do any drawings at that time. We moved, anyway, towards where the banging was going on in middle first part or middle of June, and we seemed to very quickly get involved. Nobody seemed to know what was going on, but the first thing that really happened was we heard that our whole B echelon had been captured at Merzmetru. We dropped into action.
How had that happened? Or did
They're surrounding. The Germans had just surrounded them. And
what were you doing?
Well, I wasn't in Katruk. If I'd been in Katruk at that point, I'd have gone with them. But actually, a lot of them escaped and came back again. I mean, John Evans Lawrence, he escaped. He was in charge of Vietchelon, and he escaped with a lot of other people and got back, only to be killed on the 20th of July.
So what exactly happened to you?
Well, at that point, I was in a gun position vehicle. It was RB, B Troop. GB. RB was the armoured car.
So you were with the gun position signallers of
B Troop? I was on a wireless set in GB, which is the gun position Chev of B Troop. Four guns in a troop. And we fired onto concentrations that had been allocated by someone.
Where exactly were the battery? Where was the troop?
Now, this was south of Mesnotru, north of west of Alamein. And we were quite a long way from the coast. But we were working in boxes. This is what I gathered. I mean, it was such a flap. I don't know to this day what was... Even the diaries tell nothing. I tried to find out from the regimental diaries what, in fact, was going on. But nobody seemed to know.
And you didn't know at the time?
And we didn't know, no. The officers didn't know.
So
But someone was getting orders to fire concentrations, presumably on advancing enemy stuff. And then we up sticks and we'd come back again and drop into another position until eventually we dropped into position at Alamein. And then we were told very clearly that we were to form a column, and the column was to be under the command of Brigadier Waller, Rob Waller.
Yeah, so up to this point, had you come under fire yet?
Oh, yes, yeah. We had... There was a motorised infantry unit. We thought that at one point we were going to be surrounded and put in the bag by them, but they withdrew. But they were Germans. They weren't Italians. They were Germans, and it was a closest shave I can remember.
What happened?
These lorries full of half track German lorries. And with infantry, and they were coming towards us. The great cloud of dust, subtending about 200-300 yards on the horizon, and they withdrew when we started firing on them. But at that time, we thought they were going to sweep right through us and mop us up.
Did they open fire on you?
They were firing at the time, yeah.
How did you feel? That was your first time under fire, was it?
Apart from being strafed, yeah. The Stuka dive bombers would come down every night. And
What was it like under a Stuka attack? Can you describe how you felt?
I was very, very scared at first, and then you realised that you'd be very unlucky if you copped it, because they were terrorising it, I think, more than... damaging. They only had two bombs, and they had a siren, and they come, and the sun was coming down to a couple of degrees up. They would come out of the sun, and the sirens would sort of, they were quite scary. They seemed to be coming straight for you at the beginning. You thought you'd had it, but later on, when you got used to them, you realise that. They just weren't coming straight for you, and that the bombs they dropped very often did no damage at all to anybody. They just buried themselves in the sand and blew up great clouds of sand. But you'd have to be very unlucky to get a direct hit from a Stuka.
So that was that.
The Messerschmitts would sometimes come in and strafe.
Were they worse or better?
I think they were more scary, because they use these cannon. What was it, about a centimetre?
you mean they were more scary in the sense that you were more likely to get
killed? You were more likely to get hit or killed by...
But they didn't have the... Did they have the same initial impact as the Stukas had? You said the Stukas were very scary.
The Stukas were scary, yeah, because we'd never come across anything like that before.
But only at first?
At first, and then you got more used to them, and you just dropped flat, yes. But before, you'd try and sort of scratch your way into the sand, you know. But the others, when you got strafed and you're in a vehicle, you just sort of put the brake on and just dived either under the vehicle or to the side of the road. Just, you know, there's very little cover, really. But and then the road would be swept with machine gun fire. And sometimes, well, very often, more often than not, a vehicle would go up in flames and people would get hit. But there were no big casualties until that the July do, which is what the painting's about.
Now, up until the July do is this column, which where you went out with Waller.
This is a column that was hastily formed, and obviously, why there was nobody else involved, I don't know. But the intelligence must have told somebody that the Germans were going to attack south of Rowizet Ridge. That's where we'd withdrawn to. We still had OPs on Rowizet Ridge, and we were firing on observed targets from Rowizet Ridge until then. In fact, on the right of the ridge, we had South Africans. And it seemed from rumour and from general sort of information that the South Africans were not very keen on fighting the war. I don't know what was going on there at all. In fact, after that, they withdrew altogether. We never saw them again. I think there was some sort of rebellion by, what was his name, the South African commander? It starts with a P. I heard there was some rebellion anyway on his part about losing any more men to fight the British cause.
So they were on the right of the
So there must have been some intelligence must have come through that we were going to take the brunt of the attack. And this column was very hastily formed by Waller with the Essex as the main fighting unit. There were, some
Do you know which battalion or just
yeah,
Essex?
First 4th Essex.
First 4th.
Mm-hmm. And sure enough, the attack came. On
who else were in the column? Who else was in the column? There's yourselves.
Yeah.
First 4th Essex.
But there were no other fighting units at that moment. There was just the 11th and the Essex.
But did you actually move forward from the ridge, or were you just... The column was defending the ridge?
No, we weren't defending the ridge. We were on the left of the ridge. There were OPs on the ridge.
And did the column have a name?
Yes, it was called Rob Coll. Rob Coll. Because of Rob Waller,
and it wasn't actually moving forward; it was a static column.
The orders were that we were to hold that line, that where the main prod was coming from the Germans. I was picking up some stuff because I was on the radio at that time,
but some then. Position.
Yeah, but then the OPs withdrew because the German tanks had sort of occupied the western end of the ridge, and the OPs came hurtling back. I wasn't in an OP at that time, but they came tearing back, zigzagging like that across this gravelly flat stuff, and being shot at by tanks. And so from then on, there were no OPs, and it was direct firing over open sites. And I, at that time, was in the wagon lines with the gun quads. And there was nothing anybody could do. The Essex were... there was an anti-tank platoon with 2-pounders, which was General Beckett, the guy who came and opened the exhibition when the painting was presented. He was a subaltern in charge of the anti-tank platoon. But they had 2-pounders, which were useless against
So how was the, your regiment disposed? You were in the B Troop wagon lines.
I was in the wagon lines then with most of the other vehicles, which the armoured cars stayed. That's right. The armoured vehicles had a Bren, and they stayed just in rear of the guns. And I think they're using the Bren. Why we went up there with rifles, I don't know. But it was.
So the two troops were just in front of the position.
Well, the whole regiment was in 83rd, 85th were forward, and they took the full brunt of it. My battery was maybe 400 yards to the left and rear, and they took the full brunt on the 2nd of July. We took the brunt on the 3rd of July, but eventually Rommel withdrew.
So what happened, what do you remember of those days? That's from the 2nd on, well, from the 1st onwards. What happened to you?
I was in the wagon lines, and we could see what was going on about 200-300 yards ahead of us.
What could you see? And
a lot of stuff was coming over from his tanks. We were getting a lot of overs, if you like. They were firing at the guns. There were casualties coming back. The MO, the regiment had it. There was a four-day dressing post. It was just total pandemonium and chaos. I mean, we were expecting all the time to be overrun, and yet there was damn all we could do about it. I mean, the guns were tackling the tanks.
And as it was direct sight work, and as the OPs were to come back.
Well,
as you as a gun position radio operator, you had nothing.
There was nothing to do. No, the GB. Was actually on the gun position. With the GB also carries the plane table and the theodolite, so that the gun position officer rides in GB, but they didn't need the wireless set because there was nobody to, there was no OP to connect with. So I was back in the wagon lines. I was helping to load ammunition into the three tonners. The three tonners were taking ammunition up and dumping it. Yeah,
up to the
guns. Yeah, and food was taken up. The cooks are in the wagon lines, and they just make Dixies of whatever they can, bullion and stuff. And that was it. But I mean, I think looking back, we should have been up there. Every single man should have been up there with a rifle, maybe. But I don't know. Maybe the jobs we had to do in the wagon lines were enough. Yeah, so I mean, I dodged the main impact of that. The gunners took the main impact. And there was I've forgotten what the percentage of casualties were. There were a hell of a lot.
Were the positions actually overrun? You said that they came first onto one battery and then onto the other battery.
They weren't overrun, no, but we lost. There was a whole troop. E troop was lost, and then it was reformed by stragglers who came from other regiments. Nobody knew what was happening. People were coming back. Guns were coming back from other regiments. There was one guy, from Sergeant... I can't remember his name now. But he was from a 121 field regiment. But we collared him with his gun. And they made up a new E-troop with these stragglers, these odd bods that had just come back out of the blue.
Did you come under? I mean, you were much artillery fire, or was it just tank fire?
It was tank fire and small arms fire. The tanks were quite close, but a hell of a lot were knocked out.
That's what stopped them. Did they actually break the gun line ever, or were they always stopped?
No, they eventually withdrew. They didn't break through the line. No, had they broken through, I think they would have gone on straight through because the 7th Armoured was way down near the Katara Depression, and they'd been depleted. I don't know, they were sort of licking their wounds. The South Africans, I can't to this day, know why they weren't involved in this. They were on the north of the ridge. The ridge is like a backbone coming down parallel with the sea. And we were on the south of the ridge, they were on the other side.
And there was no one on the ridge itself?
No one on the ridge, except the western end, which is shallow, was occupied by the German tanks were firing direct at our guns from there, which is mainly what that painting's representing. The they were on the, they were overlooking us until we eventually sort of, we'd fired sufficient rounds to scare them off.
So, when you came under, I mean, how did you feel under that sort of fire, though, the overs, the people, you know, yourself?
I was very scared. Very, very scared. Yeah.
Did you dig in, slit trenches?
Or? Yeah. Oh, we'd actually sort of, yeah, it was quite soft sand. It was quite easy to dig. Yeah, the wagon lines were dug in. The guns weren't, unfortunately. What was happening on the gun positions was people were just filling the ammo boxes with sand and gravel and stacking them up, making that like a wall in front of each gun.
Did you actually dig the vehicles in? How did you go about that?
Cause there's the vehicles weren't dug in. There was just enough to dig ourselves in. We hadn't been there long enough to dig vehicles in. No, we just dug our own slit trench, which is almost a reflex thing. Wherever we stopped, people just scraped a hole deep enough to lie in.
So, like coffin shape. I mean, how deep would you get?
6 feet, foot too deep, maybe. Yeah, it was really soft. I mean, even in the desert, once you got through the top sand, it became sort of more cheesy about a foot down, and it was quite easy to dig. But in the areas that were just gravel, and underneath was rock, and that was very difficult.
And there it was all right. It was soft.
There were like hillocks of coarse camel scrub and stuff, and the vehicles were in that position. And some of them got hit. A lot of them caught fire. Yeah. 1,500 weights, 3 tonners were on fire.
Now, how did you go about, the painting, they obviously can't see it on the tape, but it's in the museum and they can see it in the art collection if it's not actually on display. It's on display at the moment. Yeah. How did you go about painting that? I mean, what did you draw?
I didn't do that then.
Oh, no, I know, obviously. And how did you go about painting it? I presume you wouldn't even have a chance to do any sketches or anything then.
We pulled back and there was a quiet period when we sort of took stock of everything. The wounded had gone back. It must have been a fortnight later when I tried to reconstruct. I did drawings which tried to reconstruct what had happened, what I'd seen. But, what I was seeing was only when we went up with the ammunition and dumped the boxes of ammo and praying like hell that we were going to get a direct hit on the lorry while we were just chucking the ammo into the
car. So that's when you got your close-up view.
That's when I saw the guns in action, yeah.
And as you've represented, that's how... Did you ask survivors for any specific things or...
Well,
details or
people were talking about it for months afterwards, really, because it was a pretty horrendous experience, and we lost a lot of really good lads. They just disappeared. We got reinforcements up, and gradually, we'd tell the tale to the reinforcements. And
did you, when you were painting it, when did you actually paint the painting as it is now?
Very recently.
Very recently, because that was painted for. Did you try and paint individuals, named individuals?
I started to try and paint people that I remembered very clearly. There's some real characters. But then I realised that from memory, it's not possible. I had some photographs of these people. But, in fact, there's one in the archives of a whole gang of them sitting on a gun. But it's not possible to make an accurate portrait of somebody after 50 years, really.
So it's representational in that sense.
It's really not symbolic. It's not any specific gun in action. Well, there are two guns in action, but it's no specific gun. It's just an attempt to synthesise what happened on the 2nd of July and the 3rd of July.
So a representational rather than, it's not meant to do the job of a photograph.
It's no.
It's meant to try and convey what it meant to you.
Yeah. And there are photographs of, funnily enough, that were taken by some cameraman, some press cameraman. And it is our, I didn't know this, but Jeff Jeffson, who's my battery commander, he wasn't then, but he finished up as a battery commander. He remembers these people, and he sorted out the photographs here that were taken but they're obviously taken by somebody lying down as the gun's in action. And I've used some of the details from those photographs as well.
So it's as accurate as you could make it?
It's as accurate as possible, yeah.
Are you happy with it?
With the painting? Yes, when I went to see it with you, that's the last time I saw it, last week. It's a good painting, I think. It's got a lot of things in which I haven't seen, that all the grubby details of the tins that we cut up to make fires, you know, sooty old tins with wire handles, which we used to hang on the back of the vehicle. And the corned beef and the evaporated mill tins and all the garbage which is around. You see, there's only one other painting you've got here of £25 in action. And it's a complete sort of myth. It's the little men all stripped to the waist, but there's no grot around the gun. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of filth and dirt, and people didn't try and tidy up everything, you know, as though photographers were coming. Cans and rubbish, you know, we deserve the flies very often, the mess we used to make. And when you went for a crap, you just took your spade and went back about 50 yards and dug a hole and squatted, and, you know, nobody was going to bother about being looked at, and you filled it in again, you know. If you're dead lucky, you had some toilet paper. If not, you use message forms.
So you feel that your picture gets that sort of...
Well, that's what
the grot of life as well across.
That's what I tried to sort of put over, yeah. The heroism of the gunners, but also the living conditions.
Is there any actual symbolism in it that you felt you put in? Nothing particularly symbolic about anything in it, or is it...
No, I was tickled by John Keane's painting of the Gulf, where he painted a Mickey Mouse in an amusement arcade surrounded by turds, which the Iraqis had used as a latrine. And I painted an open book. We did have books. People, you know, we had comforts parcels from home with books in. And I painted a book on it sitting on the petrol can open, and I did a Minnie Mouse on the page of the book as a sort of... A slant towards John Keane, I think, and his Mickey Mouse. I said he didn't seem to get very far forward in the Gulf. He seemed to hang around in the back end, taking photographs, and then coming back and painting. So, I'd have liked to have gone to the Gulf and done some stuff with the extra knowledge I've got of painting now.
Did you use the sketches you took at the time? You made. Sort of a month or two later, did you use them at all in doing the final thing, or were they?
I still had those, and there are a lot of paintings. I've got about 30 odd drawings
of that scene
in the art department. Not of that scene. No, of the desert.
Do you have any other drawings of that scene? You know,
they were just rough. Drawings which you haven't got here, which I've kept, but I don't think they're good enough for the.
What do they show? They were done at the time.
They were just sort of scribbled drawings of the guns, but you see that.
Just to show.
But they're very scribbly because it's very difficult to draw a 25 pounder. You need an awful lot of accuracy if you're going to make it look right.